Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. When did cheap plastic disposables with 90s-style graffiti art become the norm? No offense if gaudy pastel is your style, but the Flonk Max Smart embodies a smarter way to vape. The Flonk is sleek and discreet, and the most popular flavors are available nicotine-free and in 2% and 5% strength. A flexible disposable with a smart LED screen, the Flonk churns out 10,000 dense and delicious puffs. Visit MyPod.com and use promo code STOOL for 25% off Flonk vapes.
Reveille, reveille, reveille! It's a Friday edition here on Zero Block 30, and today we have three rounds of the magazine. Round number one, Vietnam prisoners of war survived in part of their humor. We're going to be doing a lot of Vietnam talk. Honestly, it's mostly Vietnam talk today on the show. So we're going to talk about the prisoner of war.
Because why?
It's the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, so we're having a special...
Not of the kickoff, but it is the 50th anniversary of the last combat troops coming home from Vietnam. And that's when 500 and something POWs were released. Round number two, the Vietnam toilet bomb. We're going to talk about that. Had you guys ever heard of it?
Nope.
I feel like tourists get that a lot, I'm sure.
True. I can't even imagine the amount of diarrhea I would have if I went to like a Southeast Asia country at this point. Just, it would be brutal. Indonesia, any of those places, I'd be fucked.
A lot of diarrhea.
Yeah. All right. Round number three. It's been 50 years this week since the last combat troops in the Vietnam War came home. So one of those people is named Charlie Plum. He's a former captain in the Navy. And captain in the Navy was what rank? Oh, what, Kate?
Oh, five?
All right, give it your...
Was it five?
No, six.
Six. Yeah, yeah, six.
Five is commander.
So that's an 02. No, an 03 in the Marine Corps.
That's right. Good job, Kate. Well done. All right. Six
in the Marine Corps. I wouldn't make it even across the board. I don't get it.
When I got promoted to staff sergeant, I walked around the building, fly like an E6, like an E6, fly like an E6, like an E6.
Anyways.
Yeah, so we're going to have Charlie Plum on the show. He's going to talk about all the experiences. He was in Hanoi for 6.5 years. I mean, I've been at Barstool to put context. That's how long I've been at Barstool. 6.5 years.
Bro, that's a long time.
Think about that, man. Like the difference in my life at 34 years old and now 40 years old. These people are there six, 7 years.
Yeah, the mental toughness that takes is just absolutely, like, it's unimaginable. It's crazy.
It is. So. And when you, there were some tortured things that when I was preparing for the show, I was like, that's a little rough to even talk about, like even put out on the internet and speak about it in this kind of format. It's like, I don't know if that's even appropriate.
Yeah,
for some
the torture
of the things
and all the shit
through.
They went through. Crazy. We'll get into it.
All right, let's get into it right now. We'll go to round one. What do we got, Kate? Today's show is brought to you by our good friends at Proper Wild. If you suffer from symptoms of ADHD like I do, which includes a lack of focus, no productivity, your brain is constantly wandering all around the joint. You need a little direction. My friends, you need to check out Proper Wild's Clean All Day Energy Shot. Proper Wild uses organic caffeine stacked with L-theanine, which has been clinically shown to boost that energy, focus, productivity without all the jitters or the crash. There's no preservatives, no artificial sweeteners, no horrible chemicals, just a natural-tasting energy shot with clean ingredients that work. I love it. This weekend, my wife, he was out of town. It was me, the kids. We are playing a little bit of FIFA, actually, getting FIFA'd on, and Cardi was going all over the place. I was going all over the place. I sat down and had a little Proper Wild, and I was ready to go for the next 4 or 5 matches. High energy level, high stakes. We were Barcelona. Things were getting heated, but not as heated as they are when my heart starts warming up, thanks to old Proper Wild. Go to properwild.com/Barstool to try Proper Wild for 30% off. Today's show is also brought to you by our friends at Cross Country Mortgage. Buying a home can be one of the hardest things you can do. You need the best support available to get through it. That's why we're a big fan of Cross Country Mortgage. They're dedicated to getting you into your dream home and will stick with you in the trenches until it's done. Cross Country Mortgage has a team of loan officers dedicated to getting it done and finding you the best possible loan terms available. They have average close time of 21 days, which is ridiculously fast. They got a wide variety of loans, which means they have got everything to cover everyone. With huge variety of projects, they cover everything from renovations to refinances and everything in between. When you want someone you trust by your side every step of the home buying process, which is always, you need Cross Country Mortgage. They'll have your back from the beginning to the end and are dedicated to getting it done. Go to CrossCountryMortgage.com so Cross Country Mortgage can take care of you through the home buying process. Again, that's CrossCountryMortgage.com/Barstool. Cross Country Mortgage LLC, NMLS 3029. All loans are subject to underwriting approval. www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org.
All right. First of all, this, you were saying you were looking into the Vietnam War. I saw it was the 50th anniversary of the end, and I was looking into it too. And I feel like Americans, like, okay, I get the basic gist of what Vietnam was because of Forrest Gump or whatever, but like, I didn't even remember. I was like, why did we end up there again? Like, what was the point of that? And I just want to give a quick, and if this sucks, you can cut it, but just a quick overview of how we wound up there.
Yeah.
I'll say it. It was kind of on us a little bit.
Shocking.
Kind of on us.
Yeah. But it was time. It had been almost like 10, 15 years since Korea.
We were overdue for a banger. So
That should be the, like, the litmus test if we should go to war. Will we remember why we're going in 40 years?
Because Vietnam, I was like, wait, what was that all about again? So anyway, between 1945 and 1954, Vietnam as a whole, North and South together, was like France, the colonizers who had taken it over for forever and ever. We want you gone. They wanted the French out of Vietnam.
Which they makes finally, sense. I would too.
They finally, and meanwhile, U.S. is backing, is giving the Southern Vietnam like weapons stuff to help them boot the French out. And it finally works. They boot the French out. And then North was communist. South was regular old Vietnam. And they wanted
actually the official name, regular old Vietnam.
That would have been better than South Vietnam.
Yeah.
And they wanted to do, as a whole, they were looking to do unification elections to unite the North and the South, which probably would have meant the whole thing become communist. Okay.
Yeah.
And the U.S. was like, we're in a Cold War right now with the people backing the North of Vietnam, so we better come in on the South and keep giving them, tell them, one, don't do the unification elections. So the South Korea, because they were getting so much backing and money from the U.S., they're like, we're not going to do it, North Korea. We're not going to earn North Korea, North Vietnam. We're not, whatever. And so then, essentially, the communists
came in and we were like, North Korea, you need to get out.
Yeah, Lyndon Johnson was like, we're going to escalate this bitch. And it went from like 2,000 advisors on the ground, U.S. advisors like helping South Vietnam and giving weapons and money, blah, 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 to, let's see here, hundreds of thousands eventually in the next few years. And then Nixon took over and he was like, yeah, let's keep ramping this shit up. And they just kept ramping shit up. And then it was war.
I'm pretty sure that this is right, but I think you're right too, Kate. I think that was a
great
synopsis. A
real historian's probably dying right now.
No. I don't think so. I think they're like, yeah, Kate nailed that. I'm pretty sure it was either Korea or it was Vietnam. I read it this morning. It's embarrassing that I can't remember. 10% of all men in the United States at that time were drafted. 10%.
I would have thought it would have been a higher number.
I read somewhere where still the majority was volunteers. I don't know if that's true.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah,
a lot of those are fake volunteers, too. Like, if you read the accounts, they'll be like, oh, I got drafted, so now I'm going to pick which one I want to go to, and that no longer means you were drafted.
But overall, 58,000 American lives and 350,000 casualties wounded from that, and over 2 million Vietnamese deaths. And basically, Congress enacted the War Powers Act then in 1973, requiring the president to receive explicit congressional approval before committing American forces overseas. And we'll circle back to that at the end of the show because we've got some new news on that there anyway.
Yeah.
But that's a basic overview of how we got there. And I kind of wasn't 100% sure on that. I knew it was like us versus the communists type deal, but whatever. Anyways, round one.
That was Katie context. Amazing. That was so good. Okay. You did the roundup there. I loved it.
Okay. I tried my best. I don't know.
No, you did great. I'm not being facetious. I'm being for real.
So and I feel like every war we've gotten suckered into, like same with, I don't know. Look at the Soviets, and then when we were back in Afghanistan against the Soviets who had taken over. Like, I feel like so many of the wars we get sucked into start as just dipping our toe in the proxy war pond. And next thing you know, we get sucked into a quagmire. That seems to be our MO.
We're hanging out in Korea, or in Ukraine right now.
You know, so yeah, there we go again. Anyways, round number one. When the Vietnam conflict ended in 1973, 566 military prisoners of war were returned from captivity in North Vietnam. Over 30 years later, medical and psychological tests of approximately 300 of those prisoners showed few medical, social, and psychological problems, which is shocking. How can you go through 6-7 years of torture and come out on the other end of it okay? And the answers are varied and complex, but one thing was clear. The main thing, the glue that held their brains together, was they had a system of human connection that they worked at. They had to work towards it every single day. Couldn't get lazy, which I can see me just sitting there and finally one day being like, fuck it, I'm just letting my brain go. I'm just done. I'm just going to like zone out. They had to work towards this every single day and stay grounded and in control of their minds. And a big part of it was humor, was having a sense of humor was a big part of that glue. Though they were certainly victimized by their captors, they didn't see themselves as victims no matter what was done to them. As a POW in the Hanoi Hilton, I recall nothing from military survival training that explained the use of meat hooks suspended from the ceiling. It would hang above you in the torture room like a sadistic tease. You couldn't drag your gaze from it, said one POW. During a routine torture session with the hook, the Vietnamese would tie a prisoner's hands and feet and then bind them to their hands and ankles. So you'd be like in a backwards teardrop shape, like hogtied essentially. And then they would hang you up by those ropes on the meat hook. You couldn't breathe. You were bowed and bent in half, and you were hoisted up to hang by those ropes. And the guards would return to keep tightening them and tightening them. It could be for hours. It could be for days. All feeling would be gone. Your limbs would start to swell and turn purple. I mean, you can't think of a torture worse than that. You're slowly suffocating.
You can't, but there was way worse than that. Like some of the, worse. Like that is unimaginable to go through. Really? Like I was trying to think, when I was reading it, I was like trying to think of what that would feel like. And your brain can't do it.
No,
like,
I don't think.
Your brain cannot do it.
You can't replicate. None of us have, and most people never go through any
Thank
sort
God.
Of.
Thank God. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then. Another, but so just to, that's an example of the kind of shit these guys were going through. A famous resident of the Hanoi Hilton in 1967, John McCain joined the prisoners there after his plane was shot down. He's got his right knee and arms broken. He was denied medical care until they figured out his dad was a U.S. Navy admiral. So they transferred him to a medical facility, and he woke up in a room covered in mosquitoes and rats. Finally, they set him in a full body cast, then cut the ligaments and cartilage from his knee. But still, and after that, I think I'd be like, yeah, I'm done. I'm going to check out now and just become a vegetable in here. I'm just like done. He went on to become a known mischief maker and like one of the big morale boosters of that group in the Hanoi Hilton. Navy pilot Jack Fellows recalled about himself and John McCain. We did a Christmas skit together in 1972.
Look at that date. Look at that date. 1967 and now it's 1972.
Yep.
Jeez.
Navy pilot Jack Fellows said it was cold and there were no windows, but McCain was playing Scrooge and I was Tiny Tim. I was almost nude, wearing something like a diaper, standing off to the side waiting for my cue. So they're putting on a play in this dull, cold, dark room for the other people in the room, the other prisoners in the room. And this Fellows guy is freezing. He's wearing like a diaper. It's freezing cold. And he's just ready to get up and do his part so he can go get warm again or whatever, like in his little corner. But McCain knows that he's freezing his dick off, and so he proceeds to give a 10-15 minute dialogue. And he keeps looking out of the corner of his eye, and everyone's laughing because everyone knows this poor other fellow's guy is freezing his dick off. And he said that was so one of the funniest things, that kind of shit would happen all the time, where they were still, even though they were all in horrible pain, they still kept roasting the shit out of each other because it was funny. It kept them going.
Right. And when I was reading all these accounts and all these stories, I thought, There's nothing different about any generation of soldier, sailor, airman, or marine. Just no difference. Going back from these stories, or when we talked to Woody Williams and when they got the flamethrowers on the beach in World War II, when he's like, we got it out. We just kind of started playing with it. And I was like, yeah, dude, that's what we would have done too. Just play with the flamethrower.
Yeah, the context changes, and then maybe the references change, but it's all pretty similar.
Oh, right. Yeah. POWs who maintain strong relationships helped survive over 7 years in captivity and have thrived in the years since they've gotten out. As one man stated, believe it or not, even under the worst conditions over there, under the right circumstances, we could laugh. They would say, well, boy, we're going to look back on this one day and just laugh. And just even saying that was so dark that it made them laugh, you know.
And the last part is, but it sure does hurt now.
Yeah, but imagine being tied up by a meat hook and looking at your buddy and being like, we're totally going to laugh about this one day. Like, that's so dark that it is funny. Like,
it's like that one meme where the guy has the hangman's noose around his neck and he's like, first time?
Yeah, exactly. Like, literally, it's gallows humor. It's a dark humor.
Right.
Another participant added, the first 5 months, I didn't have a sense of humor. I was having great difficulty finding anything funny about the situation. But then I discovered by living with other people and the way we interacted that we eventually started being awfully funny. And so he saw, like, well, if these guys around me can laugh, then I can too. Then I can join them. And if I can make them laugh, then I'm valuable here. Because that
I think it would have taken me 7 years to think anything was funny.
Humor allows you to get up every morning and think this isn't the end of the world. So one's sense of humor is pretty critical. And, like, this is a much smaller scale, obviously, but I've talked about on here, after I got out of the military and was in one of my darkest points and I had gotten divorced and I moved back home and I was, like, really, really depressed. And one day I had a comedian friend down in Philly who sat next to me, and on a notebook, he's like, write down, start a list, what's funny about this? He's like, I know you can find, because I was like, there's nothing funny anymore. I don't think any, he's like, sit down and write. I promise you there's something funny about your divorce. I promise you you can laugh and find something to laugh about. And slowly but surely he was right. And next thing you know, it was like a flood. It was like, it became this funny thing that I could laugh at, and it wasn't so huge and awful.
Do you remember any of the things you wrote down?
Oh, I still have it. I turned it into a stand-up set that I used.
Yeah, I've watched it on YouTube.
But anyway, like, the power of humor, like, truly is
really
a morale booster that is absolutely incredible.
That's what we talked about in the 20-year episode. Like, the things that you go through there, you have to kind of be like, this is fucked up and talk about the crazy shit. Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
I think the thing I'm most impressed by these guys, it's no different than if you are going on a long ruck march and you just don't know how far you're going and you're just kind of walking. When you don't know where the end is, that can be such a way to screw with someone's mind. These guys had no idea. You know, when they were there day one, they had no idea if they were going to get rescued in 5 days or, 5 to 7 years.
Yep.
And that not knowing, I
you would have never thought it. You never would have thought it'd be 7 years.
No.
Never.
No shot.
And if you,
no
if
shot.
You did know, this is terrible. If I knew I was going to be in that situation for 7 years, I'm killing myself instantly. Instantly, if I know that it's going to take me 7 years.
But you say
years.
That, but then, what if you had other soldiers around you who were relying on you? Would you then? Probably not, knowing you. I don't think so. Like, I think that was the power that the unit, they talk about the unit cohesion, the cohesion between these guys, and the humor. Like, they had to be there because their buddy needed them to be there. They had to stay positive because their buddy needed it. Like, I think that was changed the whole vibe. I don't know. I think
it's
really
powerful. Being there and having to do, that's the whole thing really about war. And, like, when we talk about having different medals and people are looked at because of the medals that they have, most of that stuff, for a lack of a better word, is it's situational circumstances or it's just fucking bad luck. Like, nobody knows where you're going to be. Mm-hmm. Like Kyle Carpenter, for example, he showed immense bravery. There was tens of thousands of other Marines who stood watch on different places, Marja or Iraq, anywhere in Afghanistan. But he was the one where it happened, and he's the one who actually did it. But I also think that there's dozens of, more than that, of other soldier, sailor, and marine that would do that same thing.
Sure, yeah, for the
but
people
he was
them.
Just the one that had to do it. And if he could go back, I'm sure he would say, I didn't want to do that shit. Like,
but
no
I
way.
Bet he would do it again. You
but know, he would,
videos, yeah.
Along Kate's point, like, I think so often, like, maybe it's just because it's top of mind. I was on Twisted History talking about the Medal of Honor, and I think so often these individuals who were awarded the Medal of Honor and a lot of medals throughout military history, it was because they felt like they needed to go help their buddy. So, Kate, to mm-hmm. your point, these people didn't want to give up because maybe they did, but they didn't want to let their buddy down.
Exactly.
And I think that theme is true throughout the military for all time.
Yeah. That's why I like the old story of John Bassalone so much, mm-hmm. because that's what he did. Like, yeah. it was all about bringing his people home twice.
And it wasn't just POWs who had a sense of humor to get through things. There's also, I mean, pretty much everywhere, gallows humor across every war. Mm-hmm. But in November of 1965, the U.S. Navy aircraft carrier USS Midway was conducting airstrikes in the Mekong Delta.
This is round two.
Yep, this is round number two. One of the attack squadrons aboard was tasked with dropping the 6 millionth pound of ordnance in the war. So the sailors...
Cons, off the top of your head, do you remember how much a 155 weighs?
It's a little over 100 pounds. It's like 120 pounds, I think.
That's 600,000 155 rounds and 6 million, right?
Something like that.
600,000?
Yeah.
If you look at how many bombs we dropped across Vietnam and Laos, and there was like other countries all around there that we just absolutely, but anyway, 6 million, it was the 6 million, pound of ordnance. So the
I wonder if they
said,
had like streamers like they do at grocery stores.
At the grocery store when you're the 10,000th customer. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Well, so they said, we want to make this 6 millionth pound special. We want to do something really fun. So commander and pilot Clarence W. Stoddard Jr. was flying the mission in a Sky Raider named Paper Tiger II, and the sailors had armed it with a special weapon on its wing, the 6 millionth pound, a toilet. Obviously, this was not authorized nor standard, nor real ordnance. So how did it get on the wing?
No shit. Yeah. It should be standard. That'd be awesome.
So how did it get on the wing of an aircraft? Apparently, the head, nautical jargon for toilet, was damaged, and probably a relative of Chaps is damaged.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay.
The toilet
taking
was damaged.
Taking out that thing like a pressure washer.
And they were going to throw it over the edge of the ship, but a plane captain salvaged it prior to anyone giving it a float check. The ordnance men designed a rack, tail fins, and a nose fuse for it, so they made it look like it was a toilet that they made look like a tiny little airplane.
That's
and then
cool.
They attached this toilet plane to the wing of the plane. As Paper Taxi 2 taxied to the catapult, the plane checkers positioned themselves to block the porcelain throne from the view of the air boss and the captain.
Can't you see us doing that shit? Like, you have a toilet that you put on a helicopter, and mm-hmm. you're like, don't show Skipper. Don't show him.
Yeah, this plane, they had to hide, because obviously they wouldn't let the plane take off with the toilet on the wing, so they had to hide it from the people. As the plane catapulted off the deck, the leaders saw it, and a message came over the radio asking, what the hell was on the 572's right wing? Like, what
so they basically
what the
buzzed
was
the
that?
Tower, but with a toilet.
With a toilet. reportedly, jokes came down from air intelligence about germ warfare being conducted. Just a little poop goofing. As Clint Johnson, the air controller, arrived on station over the target, Stoddard read out a list of ordnance, concluding with, and one codenamed Sandy Flush. And off it went. They chopped the little string off the wing. It went flying. He recalls that Stoddard went into a dive and dropped the Santa Flush. When it came off the plane, the toilet turned whole to the wind and nearly struck the aircraft.
Oh, my God.
The FAC reported that the toilet whistled the entire way down.
Imagine fucking crashing your plane because you were toilet goofing.
Yeah. And apparently there was footage of this at the time. The guys even like strapped an old ass camera to the wing so they could watch the toilet fall all the way down.
See, they should have, if they would have had GoPro for that, it would be incredible. I mean, yeah. That's why we're fortunate. We can come back and look at some of our memories in 1080p. They didn't have that.
Yeah. So, you know, just a little toilet goofing, just a little way to
Got the picture right here. It looks pretty cool. It looks odd to have a toilet strapped to the wing, but it kind of fits.
Did you guys look at the second one where it's like a legit fighter plane and they have other big ordinances on it that would fuck some place. Like, it's the one that they drop in Forrest Gump, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then there's three of those on each wing, but one of the other ones is just a toilet. See, if I was the pilot there, I think I would have come up with an excuse like, look, they're out. We have 7. We need 8 to have even weight distribution. So we found this toilet. We're going to give it a go.
And as word, like a story like that spreads, like anything that's good for morale, I feel like an officer has to let it go. As long as nobody, as long as it didn't turn back around and truly hit the plane and crash.
I mean, that's the reason why they let them cut off their camis, where they are having different shit on their helmets. Like, it's because you need something to keep you going.
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with that.
And there's another story that came back too. It wasn't just the toilet, but there was also another one where they did the same thing, but with a kitchen sink. So they said that they were throwing everything at the enemy, including the kitchen sink.
Love that. That's awesome.
I was looking up other stories, and there's just countless amounts of tales that where that happened. And I think a lot of times the Vietnam vets still get overlooked. And it's sad. Like, the things that they went through and how long they went through it, they deserve all the attention that everybody else gets, because they did what was – they weren't even really volunteers, a lot of them. They didn't volunteers. And they still went, performed admirably, and they did what they were supposed to do. So I have a lot of respect for Vietnam vets, for sure.
Yeah, and it's just unfortunate. Like, obviously, some horrible things happened in Vietnam. You know, My Lai comes to mind, so that gets marred because of a horrific act, and I'm not defending My Lai by any stretch. That was horrible, should have never happened. But I think because of instances like that, Vietnam vets all get lumped in, like, oh, you were all terrible people. And that's just not the case. As you said, a lot of them just got drafted, some of them signed up, but they just went where they were told to go. So they deserve their thanks and praise just like everybody else.
Yeah, it's another one of those circumstances where we shouldn't have been there, but the people that were there did the best that they could.
Right.
That they could with what they knew. Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to round number three, and this is going to be our interview with Charlie Plum. I really enjoyed talking to him. This was from a couple years ago, and sitting there and listening to him talk, he's a very successful businessman, owns multiple planes himself. He says that he flies almost every single day. And think about that, man. Like, if for me, I don't shoot guns anymore, because I don't really like to be around them after getting shot. There's certain ones, like a hunting rifle that David Faraday just sent me, when we interviewed him. I don't go out and shoot because I don't like to be around that. Imagine crashing your plane and then being put in a place like Hanoi Hilton and being like, I'm going to go back and I'm going to fly again. Mm-hmm. Like, that kind of exposure therapy from the Vietnam vets that went through that 566,
quality sleep optimizes recovery, helping professional and everyday athletes perform their best. Only the Sleep Number Smart Bed is proven to improve the quality of sleep and provides valuable insights that can be used to support overall wellness. Talent on a college team allows the best players to outperform their opponents, but in the NFL, everyone is talented. Players entering the draft need every competitive edge they can get, starting with quality sleep. Training will only get more intense as players transition to the pros, so to optimize recovery, they can rely on Sleep Number for consistent, high-quality sleep. Experience game-changing sleep with a Sleep Number smart bed, only at a Sleep Number store.
Way outside what I'm able to do courageously or bravely. I just can't imagine doing all that stuff. Listen to Charlie Plum while he talks about his memories from there, the things that he regrets, the things that he learned from, and how his experience as a prisoner of war for 6.5 years shaped his life. Here's Charlie Plum. Now on Zero Block 30, we are privileged to have Captain Charles Plum. He graduated from the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland in 1964, and then he went on to become a fighter pilot, where he was one of the first fighter pilots ever at Top Gun. I'm sure you've heard of it somewhere before. He went on to Vietnam after that and flew 74 combat missions before he was shot down over Vietnam, and then he became a prisoner of war for 6 years. That is burying the lead, is what we would call that in the media world. But I am so happy and privileged to have Charles Plum on the show. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, chaps. And Katie?
Yes, thanks so much.
So I wanted to have you on the show because I think that of anyone who understands what the world is kind of going through in isolation and spending time alone, it's somebody that has your story, and it's real. Your story has really touched me. I'm sure you never thought that it would correlate to people in everyday American life whenever you were going through everything.
I really didn't. But in fact, the more I look at it, the more I see the correlation. You know, we are at war. You know, we're facing an enemy that we can't see, that we can't predict. Our enemy seems to be everywhere and nowhere. This virus And, you know, kind of like the Viet Cong and in your war as well, you know, you can't see those guys. And so we're, you know, we're faced with that, with that war that's going on right now. Good news is I think that we've got, you know, we've got a good leadership and we've got lots of fine people that are fighting the war. So.
And whenever you were there, we talk a lot about with Afghanistan and Iraq, like whenever you get close to the end of your tour, because I actually want to talk about some of the things that led up. After you did 74 combat missions and you had over 100 carrier landings, whenever that's going on, getting closer to the end of your deployment, your time, were you thinking about just going home? Did you have that view that I'm almost there? I've almost reached the end of my tunnel?
I certainly did. And, you know, the other guys did too. And in fact, I heard that some of the Air Force fighter pilots that actually would stop them from flying the last 10 days or so, because you really get that get home itis and you start making mistakes. And, you know, I'll never forget that the last flight that I was on, my 75th mission, and I'm looking at this, at this armada of airplanes with big, big strike, 3 aircraft carriers, 5 Air Force bases, I don't know how many hundred airplanes. And I could just see airplanes from horizon to horizon. And I felt to myself, how lucky I am. You know, I've survived 74 missions. I've hassled with the MiGs. I've taken hits from AAA and missiles, and I'm still alive and I'm going home. And, you know, I look back to those few minutes when that missile hit and think to myself, I wonder if I just didn't get a little too complacent. So.
And do you ever, I know, because whenever I got shot, I put a lot of the blame on myself and did a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking. I imagine for somebody in your position, whenever, and I watched a speech that you gave in 2012, I believe it was, when you had on really hard-nosed shoes, and you made it a point to walk 3 paces one way and 3 paces another way. I imagine you Monday morning quarterbacked in your brain while you were taking those 3 paces in your 8-foot cell over and over and over again.
You're very perceptive. That's exactly what was happening. And I felt very ashamed and very guilty at what I had done. And, you know, to the point that I just really wondered if I could ever come back to the States and face my fellow fighter pilots when I had just failed in my mission. And yeah, I certainly did. I beat myself up pretty good about that.
And going through and spending time there, was there ever a time whenever you were there, because I also saw, and you've written a lot about it as well, where you talk about having a positive mental attitude oftentimes was a killer for prisoners of war.
You know, it was. I think the actual secret was to keep it real, okay? Because you can positively think yourself right out of reality. And so it was a balance for me. Now, Jim Stockdale was our leader for a while. He was the commander of the air group, and he was shot down. And so he was the senior POW for a while. And he's quoted in a couple of books about saying it was the optimists that died in the prison. And in fact, and I approached him on that when I was still alive, because I was very optimistic, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it had a little bit to do with my age. You know, I was one of the youngest guys there, so I was optimistic. But what Admiral Stockdale and I finally decided upon, when it wasn't necessarily optimism or pessimism, it was realism. Mm-hmm. And his whole approach to leadership was, hey, I'm going to tell you the truth. You know, we're in trouble. This is going to be difficult. You're going to see some pain through this. But also, I'm going to tell you the truth, is we have an opportunity here. We are still warriors. We are still serving. We're not on the defensive. You know, pull up your big boy pants. Let's get on with this thing. And that was his whole approach and his whole attitude. It turned the whole thing around.
And going through something like that, I've read stories about prisoners of war from Vietnam learning to tap on the wall to develop a sense of communication. How long did that take for you to be able to feel like I'm making any type of communication?
Well, it was difficult because of very cumbersome code. And I was still in solitary confinement, and I hey, listen, I heard this noise in the corner of my prison cell, and I thought it was a cricket. It was a wire scratching on the concrete floor and had a note wrapped around the end of it with this code. The code was various numbers of tugs on a wire to represent various letters of the alphabet or abbreviations. And so I memorized the code. I ate the note and began to communicate, but it was really slow for a long time. But we found that communication was absolutely vital, life-saving. You know, just it was truly the difference in life or death. The guys that were put in a far corner of a prison camp and couldn't or wouldn't communicate with the rest of the guys probably weren't going to make it. It was just that serious. And the key was, it wasn't the information we were passing around. It was just the simple validation of another human being. Because in those prison cells, when it was dark and you were alone and solitary, you know, you'd lose track. You wouldn't know if you were alive or dead. No feedback, no sounding board. And the simple tugging on a wire or tapping on a wall and have somebody tap back at you meant, you know, number one, hey, somebody's responding to something I am doing physically, thus I exist. And number two, somebody cares. And it was just that comfort, you know, that we got from that communication, that validation that really saved our lives.
Well, that had to be those little tiny moments, I would imagine, of any positivity at all are extremely amplified in conditions like that. Were there, I feel almost silly asking this, were there moments, any moments of happiness and joy that you remember from that long span of time?
Absolutely. You know, I remember laughing until my stomach ached at some of the things that we did for each other. You know, every holiday we celebrated, every birthday, we'd have these wild birthday parties where, you know, we would have an orchestra and great meals and a big birthday cake shaped like an aircraft carrier where naked ladies jumped out of the flight deck. You know? And it was all in our imagination. It was all the guys next door were throwing this birthday party for me, and it was all tapping on the wall with this code. So the birthday party lasted all day, but boy, was it fun.
Wow. Amazing. That is unbelievable. And I 6 years is so difficult to wrap my head around. Like I trying to think of what 6 years in that would be. Looking back for you all these years later, is it kind of like a dot on the line, or do you have really expansive memories?
No, it's, well, I guess to tell you the truth, both. You know, I'm a motivational speaker. I make a living telling this story, and I've made over 5,000 presentations in the last 47 years. And so I relive this story several times a week. But I pick out the positive parts of it, because there's lots and lots of parts, positive parts, you know, of any challenge in life. And one of my bylines is adversity is a horrible thing to waste, because we learn from challenges like this. And I know that you are really concerned about PTSD and that you work a lot with that. Well, here's a statistic you might not know. A study was done about 5 years ago of all the combatants of Vietnam, 30.6% have PTSD. Of the prisoners of war, 4% of us have PTSD. And the psychologists and psychiatrists are trying to figure this out, because, you know, you would think that 6 years in a prison camp would be about as much stress as a guy would want to take. And, you know, why would you not have PTSD symptoms because of that? Well, because we've done really well. From 591 men, we've got 17 generals and 7 admirals. Most of us retired as senior grade military officers. We went back to flying airplanes. I still fly airplanes today. And commanding ships and fleets and all over the world.
And I don't mean to cut you off, but I think that's so important. Like being a captain, whenever I read your story and seeing you got there to Vietnam and captured at 24 years old, weren't released until 30. To me, the concept of staying in the Navy after you return is so foreign from where I believe my brain would be at. And that you continued to serve and went on to lead an entire carrier just absolutely blew my mind. And from your bio, why did you want, I would want to put on the uniform again.
I'm thinking of last year when I tried rollerblading and fell, and I was like, I'm never rollerblading again.
You know, that's really a good question, a good point. But most of us, most of the POWs in Vietnam came back and stayed in the military. You know, I don't know, why does anybody stay in the military? Why do Marines go back into the fight, you know? Mm-hmm. You went back, Katie, apparently. So it's the dedication you have. You find something you can do, a way that you can serve, and you have a purpose, you know, a purpose in life. And I came back. I married my high school sweetheart the day after I graduated from Annapolis. She hung on for 5 years, then filed for divorce 3 months before I came home. Oh, and so that was another gut punch. But I had survived, you know, nearly 6 years in a prison camp, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to survive this too. And so one of the places where I felt most comfortable was back in uniform, back flying airplanes. And so I went back to flying jets, and it worked. I'm remarried and have four kids and four grandkids, and live a very happy life.
And I think that I love your Instagram account too, because whenever I saw some of your videos, you talk about how you're in the hangar, and I just assumed that because you're a pilot Navy guy, you called like your man cave your hangar. No, you have like an actual plane in there.
I do.
not a bad stunt to have your own plane. I love that. So I know that you have a very special relationship with John McCain. Can you tell us what he meant to you?
John was my flight instructor in Meridian, Mississippi. He taught me to fly jets. A tough, tough instructor, but he wanted all of us, you know, to learn the craft, and we did. And then he showed up 5 months later than I. He was shot down 5 months after I was. And of course, I was one of the first guys to recognize him and communicate with John McCain. Well, he turned out to be one of the toughest guys in that prison camp. He had seven broken bones and he was shot down, and they were twisting his broken bones to torture the poor guy. But he was just as tough as nails. Anytime there was any interruption in the camp agenda, you knew who was behind it. You know, McCain was always causing trouble, just a maverick. And so, yes, have a lot of respect for John. Don't agree with all of his politics, but in fact, I helped bury him here last year in Annapolis in the cemetery there.
So when you heard stories that would float out there about John McCain and about, like, there's nicknames for him being Songbird, which I always thought was such trash that people would do that to him. What were your thoughts of being somebody that was there with John McCain?
Well, John's not perfect like most of the rest of us. I got a call from Anderson Cooper when Trump said that McCain was not a hero. Remember that little episode? And Anderson asked me, and I was live on his TV show, what do you think about Trump saying McCain's not a hero? My response was, hey, McCain doesn't call himself a hero. You will not find very many military guys that will accept that moniker. In fact, the name of my book is I'm No Hero. That's just kind of the whole point. And so I said, it's kind of a moot point. You know, McCain's not going to argue the fact that he's not a hero because he doesn't think he is one. Well, John McCain had a lot of faults, and as we all do, and there were, you know, a lot of reasons, I think, why somebody wouldn't think that he was a hero. But, oh, by the way, as I say, he was certainly a hero of mine and one of the toughest guys I ever met.
Oh, I imagine so. The things that he went through and that you went through, too. When you came back, what was life adjusting? Because you hear from prisoners a lot, but prisoners of war, a little bit different. How was your transition back from Vietnam back to America?
Things had changed here. That total of 7 years I was gone. And, you know, it was like Rip Van Winkle waking up after a long sleep. Well, you know, the styles had changed, the music had changed, the humor had changed. Everything changed, but it was exciting for me back to get back into the swim of things. You know, for whatever reason, Kansas had not canceled my driver's license. So I hopped back in a car after not ridden one for 7 years. This is in the Great Lakes Naval Hospital near Chicago. And I'm driving down a freeway, and I see in front of me this good-looking blonde, you know, and I got to check this out. And I drive up next to her, and she's got a mustache.
Me too.
So it was a thrill. It was no problem at all. You know, I had dreamed about that moment and lived it in that prison camp 1,000 times. I had dreamed about flying airplanes and traveling and reading and seeing, and you know, it came very naturally to me.
After you did get out, did you have a mentor or anyone? Did the military say, "We know that had to be incredibly difficult. Here are some people who are going to help you through it," or were you kind of on your own?
No, I had a lot of help, but a lot of it really didn't make much sense. The first person
with
the
military, no, something didn't make sense.
Well. The first person, well, first of all, of course, I did not know that my wife had filed for divorce. Okay. And so, every prisoner of war coming out of North Vietnam had an escort, and the escort knew all about my bank statement, you know, statement and all this stuff, but he wouldn't tell me anything about my wife. And of course, that's the first thing I asked. And so, so I got to Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and the first guy there was going to be a psychiatrist. I'm going to see this psychiatrist. And I asked him about my wife. He wouldn't tell me either. And he said, let me tell you what's going to happen to you. When I start telling you this news, you're going to go into deep depression. You're going to get really angry. And he said, I want you to go back to your hospital room and pound on the walls and kick in the door and tear your pillow apart, just get really, really, because if you don't let this out, you know, if you don't show this vitriol that's all within you right now, eventually you're going to have a mental breakdown. Well, I said, but doc, I don't feel that way. You know, I'm happy, man. I got a doorknob on the inside of my door.
Yeah.
what could be better than that?
The little things now. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So he said, no, he said, I guarantee you that if you don't get this out of your system, the sooner the better. If you don't get it out, the longer you wait, the more tragic this mental breakdown will be. Well, that was 47 years ago. I'm still waiting for the mental breakdown. So, yeah, you know, they were concerned, and they assumed that we would be zombies. They had our families briefed to institutionalize us the rest of our lives because, you know, they just thought we'd be vegetables coming out of there. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's kind of logical to expect that those kind of conditions for that long, you know, you could never be normal again. But you know, like I said, we've 591 guys come back. We've got 2 ambassadors from our number, a governor. You know, they're telling us we're healthier today, mentally and physically, than we had been prisoners of war.
Wow.
And in fact, talk about PTSD. We are sort of the poster boys for a new moniker, PTG. Don't know if you've heard of that,
post-traumatic growth.
Yeah, growth. Huh? That you can actually grow through these periods of stress. And so, in fact, there's I'm a part of a program. It's called Boulder Crest, and it's really partially run by the psychologists who have come up with post-traumatic growth, and really doing great work in Virginia and in Arizona, Boulder Crest.
And I know General Mattis is a big proponent of that too. He's talked about it, given speeches and things like that. For those that are listening to our show that are younger and they need some advice of what to do to keep yourself bored while you're quarantined, did you have any games that you developed while you were in Vietnam that you would play by yourself?
All kinds of games. I started by going back through my mind and trying to remember every book I'd ever read, every movie I'd ever seen,
wow,
every girl I'd ever dated. Now, that was the fun part.
Short list.
Wait a minute. and that took about 3 months. So I'm 24 years old, okay? 3 months to exhaust my memory. And then, so then I started to plan ahead. And I planned the next 20 years of my life around my wife, of course. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I planned it one direction, staying in the military, another direction, just cruising along, and a third direction, and I still wasn't home. So I kept thinking about that. But yes. And of course, once we got communication with everybody else, we played games. Can you imagine a four-handed bridge in four different prison cells using toilet paper to make your cards out of? Okay, it would take all day, but we had
nothing but time.
Exactly, and that's what we were, doing. We were exercising time. But no, we had all kinds of games. Anybody that anybody could come up with.
Now, did you ever, whenever you were there, one of the games was it? Because I know that as an officer, you're a smart guy, went to the Naval Academy, knew exactly how much money you were supposed to make. Were you calculating when I come back, this is how much back pay I'm going to get?
we calculated all of that, and we made plans. We spent that money.
Oh, I bet.
One of the guys sailed around the world. That's what he was going to do: buy a sailboat. In fact, he came back and did it. He came back and spent his money and in fact, homeschooled his kids on his sailboat around the world. One guy, he was from South Carolina. He was going to come back and be a pig farmer, and he had everything figured out about where he's, how he's going to buy the farm and raise the pigs. Yeah. So
it's like the pig version of Bubba from Forrest Gump.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But visualization, huge thing in moving yourself forward and staying positive and keeping going. And I think is that one of the things that really gave you hope and made you say, I am going to get through this?
Absolutely. And you visualization allows you to escape your surroundings. And, back to your question, chaps, about, people that are homebound now. And obviously I was homebound, isolated for 2,103 days. And it took a while, to figure this out, to be comfortable in myself. But, we wrote poetry, we wrote songs, I made a piano. I've been a musician, but never played the piano. But I knew that my span would span an octave plus two. I could span an octave plus one, nine notes on this piano. So I drew a piano keyboard. I knew where the black keys were and the white keys, and I would play this piano. The interesting part. Now, of course, I didn't know that much about piano. But I knew chords and the basics, sharps and flats and majors and minors and that kind of stuff. And so I would play this piano. The interesting, and it's just scratched out on my board bed, right? Mm-hmm. And the interesting part was, after 2 or 3 months of playing this piano, when I would hit a wrong note, I would actually hear that error, that discord in my mind. It was just, talk about visualization. It really was true that we could do that.
Amazing.
It's incredible.
Final question for me. All these years later, and throughout the course of moving on past that, did you ever have contact again with any of the people who imprisoned you, or would you ever dream of going back and, I mean, I know it's impossible, but do you ever think about that?
I went back 3 years ago. The head of the history department, University of Hanoi, contacted me several years ago, wanted me to come back for a project that he was doing. He wanted me to meet the fighter pilots that I'd fought against, and I'd gotten these dogfights in my airplane, and so he wanted me to meet these guys. He wanted me to meet the the camp commander, the warden, the enemy who was in charge of the prison camp and also in charge of all of our torture. He wanted me to come back meet this guy. Well, I resisted. I really didn't have a whole lot of interest. And finally, he said, hey, you know, this guy's in his 80s and really want to put you two guys together before he dies. And so I said, well, if you pay for a vacation for my family, I'll bring my family over there. So Susan and three of our four kids and I went back to Vietnam.
I imagine you never thought that'd be a vacation site for you while you were there.
No, I didn't. But but it's changed a lot, and the people are nice. And, you know, it really was. And there's some really beautiful places in Vietnam that I had seen from the air, but never on the ground. So I met with the camp commander, and it was really interesting. I went to his house, and when he saw me, he smiled and he wanted to hug me. You know, and I was just really surprised. And his first words to me were, I was proud to be your warden from 1968 to 1972. And my finest moment, he said, was keeping you healthy and happy during your stay here. I'm saying, Bubba, huh. It's me.
Yeah. Okay.
You don't remember.
I bet you wanted to throw on some gloves and just give it to him right there.
Well, you know, my mother taught me forgiveness a long time ago, and I found that forgiveness was one of the survival techniques. I'd forgiven this guy a long time ago, and I didn't have any axe to grind. But it was just kind of interesting that he denied. I talked to him for an hour. He totally denied ever harming a prisoner of war. Interestingly enough, okay, my entire time, well, I was there for 11 days, I talked to cab drivers, and I spoke at the embassy, I went to the university, I spoke to a lot of people there. Nobody would ever admit that Americans were tortured during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. My last day there, okay, I'm in a park. I'd sent my family home. I'm still in this park in the middle of Hanoi. And here's this lady selling postcards in the park. And I could tell she was my age or maybe a little bit younger. She's missing her entire right leg, okay? She's just got her black pajamas tied in a knot. And she's on crutches with this bag over her shoulder. Postcards? Who wants to buy a postcard? She was speaking excellent English. And I said, oh, I'll buy a postcard, but I want to know your story. Sit down on this park bench with me and tell me your story. She was flattered that I wanted to know. I said, how'd you lose your leg? She said, linebacker two. Now, linebacker two was the B-52 bombings, but it was a secret word, you know. And I was really surprised to hear come back with that. You know, I mean, I would think you would say it was an air raid, you know, or mm-hmm. B-52s or something, but linebacker too. So, I sort of, you know, I'm thinking I better figure out if she's legit. I said, what was the date? And she said, oh, 24 December, 1972. I said, yep, that was linebacker too. All right. That was the B-52 bombings that actually ended that war. Well, so we got to talking, and I said, you speak great English. You're out here selling postcards, eking a living. I said, you could be an interpreter, or you could be a docent in one of the museums. Oh, no, she said with a real serious look on her face, the government would never give an invalid a permit to do something like that. Mm. So I'm thinking, hey, okay, here are two people on this park bench, both scarred by this war. One of them has two airplanes, two sailboats, drives a big car, lives a wonderful life. And the other, and she was at least as smart as I am, was selling postcards in a park. And I'm thinking the only difference in the two of us was the society in which we live. That in the United States, we have an opportunity to do anything we want, to be anything we want, to succeed in anything we want. And she did not, because of the communist nature of her government. Wow. So she finally said, you're about my age. What were you doing on Christmas of 1972? I said, I was right here with you. She said, you were a prisoner of war? I said, yeah, I was a prisoner of war. I said, tell me this. You've been to the museums. You know the history. Do you think the prisoners of war were tortured? Oh, no. She said, no. The prisoners were treated better than the civilians during that war. I said, how do you know that? Oh, it's government documentaries. They show us these documentaries, and we know the truth about the prisoners of war in Vietnam. So, I don't know. Makes you pretty pretty happy to be an American.
Yeah, that'll do it. That'll do it. My goodness.
Well, Captain Plum, we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us here on our show. We'd love to have you back sometime because we haven't even scratched the surface of your amazing life.
Yes.
Absolutely, chaps. I enjoy being with you, and I've listened to a lot of your podcasts. You guys are doing a great job, you know, for the troops and the retired guys and gals out there. I salute you for that.
Thank you very much, sir.
The name of your book one more time in case anybody wants to...
Sure. It's I'm No Hero. It's in its 33rd printing. And my website is charlieplum.com, charlieplumb.com. And I autograph every book that I sell off that website. So, and of course, I'm on social media. You know, as Chap said, I'm doing a series now on, on staying at home and all the challenges
and
you
have. And it's great. If you need a little pick-me-up, I was telling Mr. Plum before we actually started that whenever my truck got stolen last week or whatever it was, I was feeling real sad sack Sally about myself and went back on Instagram and saw him talking about perseverance, and I snapped out of it real damn quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, good for you guys.
Yes, but we'll definitely be tagging him.
Thank you so much. Yes, you'll be able to find him there, and we'll put a link to your book too. Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Katie. Thanks, Jabs.
Every time I go back and listen to that interview, I'm always blown away by what. There's really three interviews that I will go back and listen to whenever I'm feeling kind of down. It's Stanley Rubin, Charlie Plum, and Robert Sweat. Those are the ones that I go back to because all of
perspective.
Right, puts everything into perspective, and the historical context gives me a greater appreciation from times past, and I'm sure you guys feel that way too with some of the other people.
How
that
I feel when I listen to our Trace Adkins interview.
Yeah. Trace Adkins.
Donkey donk, badonka donk.
Yeah, badonka donk.
It's written about cons. People can.
Yep. Let's move on to Katie News Roundup. Kate, what we got here?
Couple quick things. One, rare lizards near Fort Carson, Colorado are on the struggle bus because of noise from a local military base. It's checkered whiptails. You all know them, the Colorado checkered whiptails.
Of course.
We should have had Billy Football on to explain.
We should have. He's our resident herpetologist. Well, apparently there's so many aircraft from the base going by overhead, they have found that these, and it's only the lady lizards, are eating more and sleeping more. They're just dealing with it by saying, I can't even. They're getting out the Haagen-Dazs, and they're just dishing. They can't deal.
They're sitting on the mega couch eating bonbons.
Yeah, I guess the noise of the aircraft.
Have you ever had a bonbon?
No, but I feel like that was very prevalent in sitcoms for us growing up. That was always mentioned. Yeah. Yes.
That's women do be eating bonbons.
Okay. Yeah, that was the thing.
I just like that.
There's freaking Peggy Bundy. They be eating bonbons and they be shopping.
Remind me, little PFCs around base, around Fort Carson, who are tired of their jobs, just going to their rooms, cracking open their fucking Coors Light. Anyway, whatever.
How many of those troops do you think got one of those lizards and is like the barracks pet?
And has eaten one in the smoke pit? Probably several.
No, I mean just they captured the lizard. Did you guys do that with, like, hedgehogs?
No, checkered whiptails in the barracks.
Mm-mm. Oh, there was one of the Marines that I was with. He loved the hedgehogs. And whenever we would be in, like, a house, he would look for one. And there was one time he came out and he pulled one out of his pocket. And he was like, I got a hedgehog. And everybody's like, hedgehog.
You know what's funny about hedgehogs? I think we all grew up with Sonic, and you see a hedgehog for real, and you don't think it's actually going to look like that.
You're like, why the fuck are you not blue?
Cute as a button.
Yeah.
All right. Up next is Katie News Roundup. Let's talk you more newsy. Yeah. Jesus. Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding. Okay.
Sorry.
The Senate on Wednesday voted to repeal the legal justifications used to attack Iraq in 91 and 2003, endorsing a rare bipartisan effort by Congress to revoke the authority to wage war from the executive branch, just days after the 20-year anniversary of the start of the Iraq War.
Yeah, I think they actually met the supermajority standard of 60 votes.
Yeah, so everybody was like,
65-35,
lesson learned.
Something like
maybe
that.
We did learn something, you know?
Nah. They just wanted to take it away from Biden. They're worried that he'll fall asleep and be like, oh, yeah.
Hit a button he's not supposed to.
Let's bomb this country.
Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama. He's been holding up 160 defense nominees. He's been holding up their promotions because the military is helping military women get the abortions that they need. Mm-hmm. The first-term Republican has been blocking the military promotions as a protest against the DOD policy that grants service members leave and travel allowances for non-covered reproductive health care, including abortion procedures. 3 months ago, I informed Secretary Austin that if he tried to turn the DOD into an abortion travel agency, I would place a hold on all civilian flag and general officer nominees. Talk to some women in the military, dude. Learn about military readiness. Maybe, like, if you actually cared about the troops at all and had a reality, real hold on the situation, you wouldn't be doing that. And so hopefully they figure that out soon.
And I don't usually like the veteran shame or like say that you not veteran shame, but like you have to be a veteran to do that. If you're going to hold up military promotions, you better be a veteran.
Yeah.
Because that you work these high level flag officers. It's not like you're holding up a Lance Corporal to corporal promotion.
Right.
These people have been working 35, 40 years to get these promotions. And to put it because you're playing partisan bullshit is ridiculous. Right. You got to be a veteran if you're going to make that stance, I feel.
And
like,
for a cause that, quite frankly, hurts readiness of the military, just flat out. So anyway, and then finally, on an incredibly, horribly sad note, 9 soldiers have died in a crash involving 2 Black Hawk helicopters out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky on Wednesday night, a training accident that is one of the deadliest in Army history. We say this countless times on here, but you think like, oh, we're in more of a peacetime now and things are, but there's still so many people putting their lives on the line, going out every day, every night, training to protect this country. Mm-hmm. And when things like this happen, it's just so heartbreaking. So our thoughts are with that community.
And it's such a freak thing too, because we go through so many levels of safety to ensure that things don't happen during training. Obviously, when you're in combat, there are a lot of factors you can't control. When you're in training, it's a completely controlled environment. You go to great lengths to ensure these sorts of things happen or don't happen, excuse me. So to have a freak accident like this is just really, really sad.
Yes, it really is. Terrible.
Awful news. Yeah. All right, so I'm going to say something here so you guys don't think we're absolute crazy people who can ignore it. We record Save Rounds and Alibis now before we do the rest of the show. So when you hear us be happy and like excited, we didn't just go from that terrible story into excitement. So, all right, let's move on to some Save Rounds and Alibis. Oh, I got to tell who's going. Kate, we'll start with you. I was like, is somebody going to fucking talk?
Once again, I don't really have anything.
Oh,
no. No. Show us something. Yep, got those adult braces off. Teeth look great.
Great teeth. Yeah.
Bring it in close to the camera. Bring it in close.
Come in. Oh, wow.
They look
great,
Kate.
You can't really tell much of a difference, but.
Oh, yeah, bullshit. You can. Yeah, you can.
I think
can.
You look fantastic.
I can.
Kate, we need to go back to Coney Island again and redo it.
I know. But you know what? It's always one of those things where, like, it's the same thing as every time I get a haircut, I have this tiny little shred of unrealistic hope that I'm going to look like Cindy Crawford when I walk out of there.
Yeah.
You know? And then I don't. I thought I was going to get these off because I have such a toothy. I'm one of those weird, like, people usually are like, oh, that's a Disney adult smile where it's all gums and top teeth.
You don't have gums like that.
You don't
that.
Have gummy, not have a gummy
but
smile.
But I'm close. Danger close.
That kind of shit, the big gums gross me out. If you, I know
that
that's bad
fault.
To say.
Not
no offense to big gummers out there. But, Kate, if you had big gums, I'm not sure we would have brought you on. Because I can't look at that.
I'm all top tooth is what I'm saying. I'm all you never see the bottoms, okay?
But you're absolutely right about haircuts, Kate, because Cardi went and got – that's what I was going to have for my Save Rounds, so Kanji, you could probably go after.
Yeah.
Cardi went and got a haircut this week, took them, and Mohawk City, faux hawk in the back where it points down, almost like Wild Thing in Major League where it goes go back. And McCartney comes out, and from the front, it just looks like a normal fade type of haircut. And then they were like, boom, whenever they were showing me. And I was like, oh, my God. And I went bananas and was like, that's the coolest haircut I've ever seen. You look awesome. And, like, went real. And McCartney was peacocking around the house.
Oh, yeah.
When you're a little kid and you feel like your haircut got nailed, there's not many things better. Like, I would say haircut and getting a new backpack or
trapper
keeper
that's
sick. Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting a good carry-on bag? Forget it. That's great.
Oh, yeah. Anyways. Yeah, I was very excited about my leather purse that I got for DC trip. I showed Connor.
Yeah, it was great.
I was texting Connor for about 20 minutes about a bag. It was weird. Yeah. Especially for me.
Yeah. Well, that's all I got, which is sad.
That's not sad. It's not sad at all. Also, Cons, go ahead.
Well, speaking of haircuts, I was just reminded of this memory today or the other day, and I wrote it down because I wanted to share it with you. So I had a shaved head all through grammar school, 3 of my 4 years of high school. College, you know, I grew it out a little bit, not too much. I've never had long hair, but I was thinking back to grammar school, and my dad would just cut my hair in the garage. And one time, he's like, what if we just take all the guards off and just take it down, like, real, real short? I was like, yeah, sure, cool. And I think that was in, like, 7th grade when we did this. So he took it down real short, and I was like, oh, this looks great. I went to school, I don't know, the next day or two, and the principal, who's this, ugh, sorry, Sister Geraldine. I'll say her name, Sister Geraldine.
There we go.
She hated me. She hated me. I was seemingly always in trouble, even when I wasn't doing something wrong. Me and my buddies were always the ones they would point to and be like, you're doing something wrong.
Why? You don't seem like you're a rapscallion kid.
I wasn't really. I guess I, you know, got into a little...
I think of you like Manny on Modern Family. Like, that's God.
Yeah. No, I was mostly pretty well behaved. Right? You know, I did some things here and there, but nothing... I was pretty much a rule follower. So, but I'm walking down the hallway one time. She stopped me. She's like, why is your hair cut that short? She called my parents and said, why does your son's head look like he's a Nazi? My dad lost it.
Oh, I bet.
Oh, my God. He absolutely...
As he should.
He's not a... How dare you call my son that? Like, he flipped out on this nun.
He's fucking 10.
Yeah, exactly. So I just had that memory of cutting my hair real short. And obviously now I cut it really short. So I'd love to see what she's up to now. Show her my haircut. She's probably dead, to be honest with you. I just hate to say it.
Yeah, good,
sorry.
Honestly. Yeah. What else you got, Cons?
That's about it. Oh. Sorry, really quickly, because I got a lot of flack for my take on having a tux. Having a tux is no different than wearing your dress uniform, people.
Yeah, but you wear your dress uniform because you're told to. It's like you're ordered to.
Yeah, but you wear your dress uniform a lot of times when you're in the military. If you go to like a wedding and it's black tie, I remember I went to a black tie wedding when I was still in the military, wore my dress uniform.
Yeah, I mean, I would rather wear that than a tuxedo. But when you're talking about most guys, I would bet 5% of modern men have a tuxedo.
Own their own tuxedo. Yeah, it is probably a smaller number, but I still think it should be higher.
So, okay. That's all I got. One thing I'm super excited about, if you've been listening to any other podcast, I don't really talk about it much here, but I'm a huge Discovery Plus guy. I love all those shows, like Thousand Pound Sister, Thousand Pound Best Friend. I'm going to start a little thing where I'm going to be talking about it more. I've been wanting something to blog about that I'm passionate about, and nobody else blogs about it. Everybody's talking about sports and basketball and baseball and all that shit. Nobody's talking about the fats, Kate.
Thousand Pound Sister's getting divorced.
What?
I know.
She's married?
Her and Michael.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they're both married.
They have two kids, yeah.
Wow. Sister Mike getting divorced.
And
she just posted a photo sitting on a porch with a very expensive Louis Vuitton bag, so who got her that?
Amy did?
Amy.
Wow. And Amy's husband, I like to call him Simple Michael, because he doesn't talk much, and he just kind of sits there and agrees, and... He looks like he wasn't in danger of being invited to law school. Like, whenever he talks, there's no question he wasn't going to do that. So I'm excited about that. If you have any TLC shows you want me to get into, because I'm doing all of them. I'm doing My Strange Addiction. I'm going to do Prisoner of Love, which is one where there's like a matchmaking service where the guys are in prison. Some of them max security prison, and there's a matchmaker who they just talk on the phone. There's all kinds of shows that are wonderful, and I'm going to start breaking them down. Can't wait to do that.
Regular cable or all streaming?
I basically am one of those idiots that probably has everything bundled from a couple sites. Yeah. I think I pay for multiple apps in multiple places.
Yeah, I'm the same way, but like, I can't imagine not having cable. I don't really watch many of those channels that you're talking about, like TLC, Discovery. They're just all sitting there. I watch like the movie channels, network stations for sports and whatnot, And that's like it. I have so many channels that I never touch, but I can't imagine ever giving them up.
Yeah, I have YouTube TV and then ESPN Plus, Disney Plus, Hulu. I have all of them. And I think like one of them comes in a bundle, but I just don't know where to cancel it or which one is under what email address, because I use three email addresses, which I want. I'm sick of that shit, too. We should go back to a society where you only have one. I only have one cell phone. Why do I need five different emails from different places? I don't want that shit.
What do you mean?
Even at work, I have Chaps at Barstool Sports. I have McNeely at Barstool Sports. I have Chaps. I'm giving out all my fucking emails.
Yeah, if no one email him, or maybe do. I don't know.
Chaps McNeely at gmail.com. I got Matthew Cothran at gmail.com. I got Cothran124 at gmail.com.
I think you're the anomaly. I don't think most people have this many email addresses.
I don't even know the passwords for a lot of them, honest to God.
I think people probably have a personal and a work, and that's it. I think you're the anomaly.
Kate, I don't think Kate's looked at her email in like 2 years.
No
right?
shot.
No, I swear to God, I have not. If you tried to reach me,
we'll get like group emails that all of us have to do, and I know immediately I have to text Kate and let her know.
Oh, like, my personal email, I have family members like desperately trying to reach me on there, and I'm like, sorry.
What are we looking at right now, Kate? Grab your phone. What are we looking at right now as far as...
Oh, I have nearly 20,000 emails, I think, between three...
Oh, no. I mean text. Where are we at on text? Because I think a lot of people have that. I have I have crazy numbers for unread emails, too.
I remember when I got up to like 890-something, my Aunt Peggy made me go down to her beach house, and she sat me down, poured me a Bloody Mary, and was like, you're not getting up from this table until you respond to your fellow relatives and you start opening these texts. And
heck yeah, Aunt Peg.
She's like, you're not leaving this room until it's under 50. And her, they had like an intervention for me. They're like, you need to get...
Yeah, but that kind of makes it worse. And then it goes back because you answer all those texts. Yep. And then there's going to be multiple texts from those people. Oh, great to hear from you, Kate. How's work going? How's cash?
If you're a psychologist out there, tell me what that is. It's an anxiety thing. I build them up and then I get afraid to check them, even though I know it's nothing bad, and then it gets worse and worse and worse, and then I'm like, oh, I better start a new life.
Yeah, that's not unique to you. A lot of people are like that. That's weird. I couldn't live that life, but
it's not.
Kate definitely has like object permanence, where if it's not in front of her face, she's not thinking about it.
100%.
If I don't look at my phone, it doesn't exist.
Ignorance bliss.
Used to do that with my bank account big time when I was very poor. Like, well, if I need to go to the grocery store, I'll just figure out if there's not enough money in there. I don't want to know. I want to think that I'm not completely poor, but I have like $9, so I am completely poor.
Would you rather know you have $9 or go to the grocery store and feed yourself?
Oh, I'm hoping that the overdraw kicks in.
Yeah.
Like that. Honest to God, I used to do that. When I was a single dad and money was really, really tight, I used to try to keep and make sure that if I was getting very close to having no money in my checking account, I would leave like $4 or $5 and prepay at the pump so I could fill it up and overdraft by like $30.
All right. That's one approach to managing one's finances.
Yep. All right. Sound the retreat.